Hello, I'm Peter Ayers, and you're listening to Stages, the podcast that converses...
The reality of that 8-show a week slog is really hard.
When I start on a character, I have to draw them, and I'm not an artist.
This is, in effect, built in myth and mystery. So you'd be sitting in this tiny little bio box with radiators all around you.
Which was a funny thing, because I don't think that play would have happened in that way if it wasn't at Griffin.
You're a bit different to the other girls in this area.
Yes, I thought, yes, I am.
That was the days when they could smell an actor or a singer and think, oh, I've got 6 weeks.
My sisters really taught me that I had to be versatile.
This ostrich, pink ostrich feather sticking up out of my hair, out of this wig.
My first career, as it were, was preparation for my second career.
And her face was beaming. It was just beaming at me.
I hadn't lost any of my passion or love for it, so it's been a joy to talk to you. Thank you very much.
As we draw towards the end of our sixth season of the podcast and chalk up 440 plus episodes, from time to time we will reach into the archive to feature conversations and creatives previously featured on Stages. Stages spotlight such episodes in case you missed them first time round, or so you can simply savour a second listen. The Stages podcast opens an essential doorway to access precious oral histories from people who were and are on and around our stages. Conversations with creatives about craft and career. In this return episode, we spotlight a conversation with Jonathan Biggins from February 21, 2019. Jonathan loathes all forms of social media. When I invited him onto Stages, he told me he'd never listened to a podcast, so I was thrilled to introduce him to the form. Mr. Biggins is charming and armed with a wit we relish and crave. He is one of the creators and performers of The Wharf Review, a popular entertainment that has demanded a date on the calendar annually. Well, it's that time of the year once again, when the silliness and satire takes centre stage in a season at Sydney's Seymour Centre. This year's offering, The Wharf Review, Pride in Prejudice, has been written by the team we adore, Jonathan Biggins, Drew Forsyth and Phil Scott. Incidentally, who all have been featured on the podcast and can be found in the Stages archive. The cast consists of Mr. Biggins, Mr. Forsyth, Mandy Bishop, David Whitney and Andrew Warboys. Bookings at seymourcentre.com from November 8th. Jonathan Biggins is responsible for some of the biggest laughs I have ever had in the theatre. And so it was a joy to find out why in this insightful conversation, which, as I say, was recorded in February 2019.
Now, Jonathan, you've crafted a career as a performer, a writer and a director where words are a lifeblood. Were books important to you as a child?
Books? Yeah. Well, yes, because my father was a professor of English and my mother worked for the ABC. So books were a very important part of our childhood. In fact, the house is full of books. It's almost collapsing under the weight of the books that are there, even to this day. So, yeah, books were important.
What's a significant book from your childhood that you recall?
Well, we were talking about this the other day, and I still would have to say The Swallows and Amazon series by Arthur Ransom. Which was set in the Lake District of England, people, you know, children messing about on small boats. And he was one of the first authors to that notion that children take responsibility for their own lives and they go away from the adults and they create this sort of fantasy world of pirates and exploration and, you know, going out to sea, but they're on a lake in small dinghies. And that very much appealed to me. And Arthur Ransom, I mean, he was an interesting fellow. He was actually Trotsky's press secretary for a while and a war correspondent in Russia during the First World War. Very interesting bloke, but he had an obsession with small boats and camping and outdoor life and all that sort of stuff. And he wrote this series of children's books that just I read over and over and over again.
Speaking of Russia, on the plane recently, I saw The Death of Stalin. Have you seen that film?
Hilarious.
It's one of the funniest movies.
I think it's yeah, it is one of the best films I've seen for a long time.
Yeah.
Very, very funny. Very theatrical, and I think that's
And full of those wonderful actors who are all heightened performers.
Very heightened performers, very heightened script, but, you know, interesting and a meaty subject and And I dare say it's actually not far from the truth of what happened when, and that sort of, you know, the notion when tyrannies and despots become the black farce that ensues, and just, you know, people being shot left, right and centre, and you just think, yeah, that's what it must have been like, just during the terror, just ridiculous.
And comically it was very black, of course.
Very black, yes.
Which appeals to our sense of humour, I guess.
Yes, it does.
But what else makes you laugh?
Well, again, I guess, I mean, my parents are both English. I was born here in Newcastle, in New South Wales. But very much that sort of English sensibility. I remember we used to watch as a kid, we'd watch Morecambe and Wise. I think Eric Morecambe is one of the funniest people ever, and a very skilled comedian.
He makes it look effortless, but obviously it was planned down to the...
Yes, yes, but he's naturally funny. I mean, some people are just naturally funny. I think that... that is something that is inescapable. You can, you know, learn comedy, you can learn techniques and things like that, but you are either funny or you're not really.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean you don't have a sense of humour.
No.
I mean, everyone has a sense of humour of some sort, but I think comic actors, and the good thing, you know, the nice thing about Eric Morecambe, he was a comic actor. At the moment, we're a little under the tyranny of the stand-up comedian, which, you know, they're great and they're fun and everything, but after a while it becomes a little repetitive. It's like everybody's Facebook page actually looks exactly the same. And I think after a while, you know, formats like that tend to become repetitive, but it was nice that, you know, if you can explore a few more things, being a comic actor rather than just a comedian.
The Goon Show, was it?
Love The Goon Show. Yeah. Well, not at the time so much. At my school, you were split into Goons fans or Monty Python fans. Needless to say, I went to an all-boys school.
Right.
And I came to the Goons much later when we were doing a show called Ying Tong, which was a English play written by a guy called Roy Smiles about Milligan having a nervous breakdown because he was a manic depressive and suffered from it all his life. And the pressure of writing The Goon Show broke him many times, and he would go into hospital for prolonged periods, and this is one of those periods. And I played Peter Sellers, and the second half of the show was sort of like an extended Goon Show sketch set inside Milligan's brain.
Yeah, I remember it. It was wonderful, and you were wonderful as
well.
Yeah,
it was great fun to do
it. And Sellers being a great mimic and impersonator.
Absolutely.
Which, of course, you are as well. So.
Well, I'm not as good as he is, but,
but
it's like, I mean, I think Steve Coogan is the modern Peter Sellers.
Yeah.
And the... Both of those people elevate beyond mimicry or just impressions. They take it somewhere else. And when you watch... I mean, I'm a big fan of the Steve Coogan, Rob Brydon road films.
Yep.
And Rob Brydon's very entertaining and very genial, but when Steve Coogan does it, there's something else that takes the impression slightly further, and it really does become a character that is inhabited solely by him. And that's what Peter Sellers was. And Peter Sellers said of himself, he said, "I am no one but the characters. I'm like Blue Bottle, you know, it's just brown paper and string." And, you know, there's been many psychological evaluations of Peter Sellers because he was nuts and very unpleasant.
Mm.
Not a very nice guy. Treated his family appallingly and everyone he worked with, pretty much. Apart from Milligan and Harry Secombe, really. I mean, the Goons was actually the happiest working
family
time of his life.
Yeah.
But he was just a cipher, really. He said, "I'm a vessel to be filled by other people." And he was transformational.
And interestingly, too, Sellers and Coogan are both fabulous dramatic actors.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, that's the thing, yes.
You know, with Coogan and Philomena and...
Yes, yes. And it's a great skill when you can... you know, be funny and do impressions and things, but then when he's being someone like Alan Partridge, it's complete. And it's not just an impressionist doing, you know.
So what do you think, how does that work? A lot of those great comics are terrific dramatic actors. Is it finding there's an authenticity in the comedy which they can transfer easily?
Yes, I mean, the best comedy works when it's sort of grounded in some sort of reality. I mean, that was the interesting thing about the Goon Show. You can be as fantastical as you like, but as long as there is a belief in the situation. So when Blue Bottle and Eccles are in any situation, they very firmly believe that what is happening to them is real.
And that's an essential component of farce as well, isn't it?
It's the essential component of farce. Yes. If the people in the piece don't believe that everything is happening, it just goes... I mean, farce is a very delicate thing to get, I reckon.
Well, you directed that fantastic production of Noises Off at the Sydney Theatre Company.
Yeah.
So...
Yeah, and we made sure that what was happening was grounded very much in reality. And it's difficult over a long run to sustain that because, you know, obviously the actors...
Seduced by the laughter.
Well, they, yes, smell the blood in the water and go, hello, this could be better if I made it bigger.
Yeah.
Nah, not really. Yeah. Pull it back. So that, yeah, and I think Steve Coogan really, really does do that. He's, to my mind, you know what I mean? And also the bravery in those road films of saying, this is me... And then painting a very unflattering picture of yourself, and they get progressively blacker and blacker. And the last one was just totally depressing, and quite prescient actually of the Me Too movement, when you know these middle-aged white blokes were wandering around just seeming more and more inadequate.
Can comedy become just too wrong? Is there such a thing as going too far?
Well, there is. I mean, it all depends on your audience. I think you have to be very careful. I think with comedy, no subject is taboo. It's just who you say it to. And I think the danger these days is that people put everything out on social media, and that's the public domain. It's not talking to your friends in the pub. It's not talking around a dinner table with your family. You know, you can do the funny voices and do all that sort of stuff and with your family, and it's fairly safe. But as soon as you put it on any sort of format or Facebook, whatever, it's in the public domain. I think there is a new Puritanism.
Yeah, I was going to say, sweeping... I think we've lost the ability to laugh at ourselves.
Yes, yeah. I think I liken it to the terror after the French Revolution. And it happens with every revolution. I mean, you look at the Chinese Revolution, when Mao came in with the Cultural Revolution after that. You have a movement that is broadly, everyone ideologically agrees with and is seen as a great step forward, and we all get to that point. But then the purists, who think we have not come far enough, then hijack the whole thing, and you enter the world of Robespierre, where, you know, if you are not committed to the revolution 110%, in his eyes, off to the guillotine. And I think that's happening now, but, you know, you just got to wear it, haven't you?
Yes, well, world leaders are a bit of a worry at the moment, aren't they?
So. Oh, sure, but, yes, and I don't think they're setting a very good example, but the thing about classical liberalism, which is, it allows us free speech, you know, all the values of the Age of Enlightenment that we all hold so dear, is being crushed by a pincer movement, and it's coming from the right wing, and the left wing. And the danger is that all the purists on the left wing who think they are doing it for all the right reasons are actually being just as destructive of the notion of liberalism and the freedoms that it contains as any neo-fascist on the right wing.
Yeah.
So we have to be very, very careful. I mean, sometimes I'm subscribed to The Guardian, of course, but sometimes you think, oh, come on, really?
Yeah.
Get off the sanctimonious high horse, live a little, to err as human. To forgive is divine, but there's not a lot of that happening at the moment.
No.
And yes, I understand where it's coming from. It's coming from all the right motives, but really, when you reach that sort of ideological purity, you do begin to lose nuance, irony, you know, all those things that make Western or any society, any sort of free society, enjoyable and interesting and stimulating. But this notion that you can crush an idea simply by banning it, or I think, is not the wisest way to do it.
Now, I assume you don't have any social media accounts.
No, I don't.
You're not a fan of social media.
No, I'm not. I don't think it's a good idea, really. I mean, it seems like a great idea, but like all great ideas, I mean, I think there's something positively Orwellian about it. And I think George Orwell made the mistake. He thought Big Brother would be controlled by the government. It's actually in private hands.
Yeah.
And that's even more scary.
Yeah.
And with the fact that Mark Zuckerberg controls 60% of the voting rights on Facebook, it's him who has 2.5 billion followers. And as a mind experiment, it was so rapidly embraced by everyone, no one even stopped to think. And all the people who would have, you know, been outraged had any government suggested that we surrender so much to them, happily, oh, it's great, you know, I can find old friends from school. Yeah, well, but what are you giving away while you do that? Or Twitter. Yeah. Why any self-respecting person is on Twitter anymore is beyond me. When you see what Donald Trump does, when you see how it's manipulated, when none of it is necessarily true, and it's a genie that has been let out of the bottle, no one's got any control over it other than to ignore it. But people like crack cocaine just cannot kick the habit.
I read a quote of yours in an interview. You said, democracy is not everyone having an opinion every second of the day. That's anarchy.
Yeah, well, yeah. I think that
sums it up beautifully.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you're going to have parliamentary democracy, you've got to respect the institution that elects a government for 3 years, and if you don't like them, you get rid of them. I mean, how can you have anyone in a position of leadership with long-term strategies to fight anything these days? Debates are always endless now. It's like Brexit. What a debacle.
Yeah, yeah.
And no one even really knows what's going on, yet it occupies all their time.
People weren't informed, and they just went in there and...
Yes, but you could argue, I mean, both sides can argue endlessly, but debates never end now because someone can say, well, I don't like that.
Mm.
And then suddenly you're listening to 40 people who tweeted and created a Twitter storm, and you think, well, hang on, how many of those people actually did it? And then when it was retweeted, how many of those were bots? How many of those tweets were generated by a machine in Russia or some guy in Macedonia sitting there trying to get... clickbait.
Yeah.
Why are we listening to these things? Why is policy being determined by these things? I just find it extraordinary because I think we're going to have a slow food movement for the mind.
Mm.
And I don't mean just watching the Garn go to, you know, Adelaide to Darwin on SBS for 17 hours. I think people are going to start thinking about, in the same way that people now think about, well, what are we putting in our bodies? You know, organic food, all that sort of stuff. What are we putting in our heads? And I don't think the answer is very nutritious at the moment.
So you grew up in Newcastle.
Yes.
What sort of child were you?
Was I?
You went to a boys' school? Did you fit in? Were you jock?
No. Oh, God, no. Jock? You've got to be kidding. No, we're in as much as we ran from the bullies, but I suppose we were jocks. Newcastle back then was completely different. I go up there now and, you know, you just don't recognise the place because it was an industrial town. I think there were two cafes in the entire city, maybe three restaurants. And, you know, we just went to the beach.
However, I think culturally and artistically it was quite a rich
city. Oh, it was eventually, city, yeah.
Because a lot of people have come out of Newcastle.
Oh, yeah. But when I was a kid, right, there was nothing. I joined the cathedral choir. Another source of bullying at school. Not many kids in Newcastle Boys High were in the cathedral choir. But ironically, it was a selective school. They're supposed to be the nice kids. But look, I had a couple of very good teachers who were very inspirational. Great English teacher, great history teacher. There was no drama or music or anything like that.
No.
I mean, I'm not a big believer in fame schools.
No.
I think if you want to be for want of a better word, an artist, you should be kicking against something, not being handed to you on a plate. So there was a lot to kick against in Newcastle, but there was a outfit called Young People's Theatre, run by Bill and Betty Ford, who did very traditional sort of, you know, canvas flats and legs, proscenium arts theatre for kids, and Bill would write a pantomime. You'd play it for a year. Every Saturday you'd turn up and you'd do, you know, a show in the afternoon, you'd have classes in the morning. And they taught you everything about the theatre, from stage management to lighting to... We helped build the new theatre. I worked as a builder's labourer for a couple of years because one of the parents taught building at Tech, so he undertook building this entire new theatre. You would do plays. Eventually, you know, it got a little bit more modern and we were allowed to do self-devised work. Angry young teenagers doing, you know, collections of poems and things like that. So it gave me a very good education in traditional theatre skills, and that was invaluable. So I did that for a greater part of my teenage years.
And then as a young adult, did you move into community theatre?
Young adult, went to uni, started there, and we, the drama department at that time, had been going for a few years, and it was the beginning of the Hunter Valley Theatre Company started up in 1976. I made my first appearance as a horse in Equus in 1976, joined Actors Equity.
The whole horse, not the front end or the back end.
No, we were unique.
You were the whole
discreet horses, yes. I wasn't the hero horse. I wasn't Nugget, although quite glad I wasn't Nugget because, you know...
Because you had to have a naked boy jump on you.
It'd been years. Mm. Tony Sheldon, as it was.
Oh, wow.
I was one of the horses that pushed the boxing ring around.
Yeah.
In the sort of, you know, orgiastic frenzy that is the climax of Act One.
And were you in tights?
Brown velour.
Excellent.
I think of a tight velour flare, a skivvy, and then these extremely elaborate metal bloody heads that never really held onto your head.
No.
Always thinking, this is going to fall off in any minute. And then these platform hooves. So we look like, well, you know, Hush meets Royal Randwick. That's what it looked like. It was 1976. And then we had to have our eyes poked out, of course. Spoiler alert if you haven't seen the play. So that was quite good. Anyway, I went to uni and they had a policy of getting a professional director to direct a main stage show for the students each year. First chap in was Arnie Neamy, who directed me in The Critic, Sheridan. And he said, oh, look, you know, if you ever consider going into the business, give us a ring. And then the following year, he came up to be artistic director of the HVTC. So I took leave of absence from my studies and joined them for 2 years. And that was another brilliant experience.
So Hunter Valley Theatre Company really was your training?
Yeah, 2 years of being in an ensemble. Mm. And we would rehearse during the day and play at night. And we would do a new play every 4 weeks. With no down weeks. It was I don't think you could do it. You had to be young and single, really. It was pretty full on. But everything from West Side Story to Man from Muckanuppin, we premiered a new play by a local playwright called Essington Lewis, I Am Work, which had many incarnations. We brought it down to Sydney, it won the Critics Award, took it away to Adelaide, brought it back years later as a co-op at Belvoir Street. I mean, that play has been... but again, you know, we're sitting there, hardly any, you know, not many audience, and David Williamson was in town to see the opening of Gallipoli, I think, which he had written, and he saw this play, and he wrote to the paper the next day saying, I cannot believe that there is an empty seat in this theatre. There are any empty seats. This is... And then from that on, it just took off, and it was a huge hit. But it needed the imprimatur of...
Mr. Williamson.
Someone outside. Mm.
Were you the class clown during your school years and uni years?
A bit of a class clown.
Where did you develop your skill for mimicry?
I was a kid, probably, with the family.
And as that beginning, like doing Monty Python and
yes, all that sort of stuff. I used to be the court jester or something running around the house. I don't know where that was from, with barbecue tongs. Clicking them, I seem to remember that. And at YPT, and just with the friend group we had, they were also, you know, into that sort of comedy and stuff. And then that just sort of continued. And I think also when you're a 20-year-old or 21-year-old actor, 22, and you're having to play a wide variety of roles, way out of your age range, way out of, you know, what you should be doing, you just have to develop those skills.
I love that you embrace a sense of the ludicrous.
Mm.
I'm not pissing in your pocket, but you're one of the funniest men I've ever seen on a stage.
That's very kind of you. you wouldn't guess from this interview.
No, I guess. Are you funny in civilian life?
Not really, no.
You obviously have a sense of humour.
Oh, I do have a sense of humour. I think I'm funny, but those around me, my family think I'm, you know, lugubrious, I have no friends, and I whinge all the time.
Right.
That is my daughter's description and my partner's description of me. And my sister's, Johnny No-Mates, I think, is my nickname.
No.
Oh, pretty much.
They're so cruel, right?
Yeah, they're very cruel. No, I don't... I don't sweat the small stuff. Oh, yeah. But I do whinge a lot about broader issues and broader philosophical issues, caused me a lot of anxiety, whereas small stuff, I couldn't care less, really. I mean, anything goes as far as I'm concerned. Not much annoys me now, but I'm not overly funny.
In civilian life?
Not really, no.
But on stage, you know, I've seen you in The Venetian Twins, which is one of the funniest nights I've had in the theatre. Mm. The Importance of Being Earnest, which is just all that classical witticism. Yin Tong, of course, which required you to capture Peter Sellers. And Travesties, which is quite, you know, sophisticated Stoppard writing. And you're adept at all those styles of comedy.
Well, that's very kind of you to say so. But Travesties is a fabulous play. In fact, I saw it on Broadway with Tom Hollander.
Hollander, yes.
He was great.
Yeah.
I mean, I love Tom Stoppard, and I was very privileged. I got to interview him at the Opera House in one of those sort of, you know, meet famous people interviews. Yes. And he was delightful. He actually came and saw The Review, which I thought was very kind of him. Very nice chap, but, you know, he never went to university. Super clever. And the great skill about Tom Stoppard is he makes the audience feel smart. And mind you, a lot of people went to Travesties and left at the interval thinking that was the end of the show because they just thought, oh, yeah, well. And some people couldn't quite follow it. It's very complicated.
Well, you have to go in with Travesties. You've got to have that knowledge of the importance of being earnest and
to fully appreciate
those historical figures.
And, yeah, if you don't know Tristan Zara or James Joyce or Ulysses. But there are whole slabs of it. I mean, I remember once I'd taken the kids down to the Dawn Fraser pool trying to learn my lines, and there are these two paragraphs where he's describing the horrors of the First World War and his experience in the trenches, and then the second one he's instructing his butler, the late Robert Alexander, in that production, on what clothes to put out. And you're thinking, this is a bit odd, why are these? And we'd already been rehearsing for 2 weeks, and then I suddenly thought, oh my God, these are homophonic, is that the right word?
Mm. Yep.
Reflections of each other. The sounds of both sentences, of both paragraphs, are the same. And he had written a homophonic reflection. Now, no audience is going to pick that up. They might. Took us 2 weeks of looking at it, and it only just clicked. I thought, God almighty, I mean, talk about smart.
Yeah. Well, that's right, to sit down and write something like
that. Well, to do it, and then, and I mean, very difficult for poor old Robert to learn his stuff about the Russian Revolution, all those repeats where suddenly, you know, someone has a mind shift, you go back, and it's altered by one or two words, and you have to get the words right. You cannot, there is absolutely no room for paraphrasing. It's got to be spot on word for word. And at the same time, hilarious. That's the sort of comedy I like. It's got ideas in it that actually says something. And that's why I think, you know, we were talking about the death of Stalin. I mean, that's a great, because it's about something. And it's still very, very funny.
You're quite a consummate writer as well, you know, a playwright, and
some would argue otherwise.
But the Sydney Wharf Review, which has been running for 20-something years, etc.
Yeah.
Is it easy to write a joke?
It is, I think, a discipline that you sort of get into, and there are ways and techniques that you can use. It's interesting the difference between prose jokes and sketch jokes, and then play jokes and stand-up jokes, or direct address jokes, if you're just doing one character doing a monologue. I mean, the differences are there. And you certainly learn all the tricks about, you know, make sure you put the phrasing right, the economy of the language. I wrote for Fairfax for 7 years, doing a column in the Good Weekend magazine every fortnight.
That's right.
800 words with a deadline. Got to have a deadline. Happens with that deadline. And that was quite good. And I think I learned a lot from reading Clive James, when he used to be the TV reviewer for The Observer. Hilarious, yet very clever. But the way he wrote prose jokes, or his book, Unreliable Memoirs, the first volume is still one of the funniest books I've ever read. And I look at it and you think, why is this funny? It's not. But it's just hilarious. And the way...
Well, it's relatable. He captures something in our imaginations about a childhood in Australia.
Yes, but it's also just the economy of the phrasing and the economy of the language. And he continued that into his newspaper writings. And so that was a useful guide. And then the sketch writing just sort of develops and you just sort of get better at it as you go along with experience. You just, brevity is everything, cut to the chase.
Let's look at a couple of the products. Orpheus in the Underworld, which is adaptation.
How do you go about with Philip Scott? Well, Ignatius Jones was directing a production for OA, and he asked Philip and I to do the libretto. Now, that's really hard because, well, we're not native French speakers, and it rhymes in French, but when you do the literal translation, it obviously doesn't rhyme. So we had a literal translation and a couple of adaptations that we could look at, but then you look at the adaptations and you think, well, I can't do any of that because then we're not being original. And then, for example, the end of Act 1 or Act 2, there are 12 different vocal lines, all with an internal rhyme, all singing different things, most of which you can't hear because they're all singing at once, but you have to write it all out. Luckily, Philip has been the best tutor in how to write lyrics. And lyric writing is even another
skill.
Thing. Mm. And most people fall down on the fact that their lyrics are not very good. And lyrics have to work in a way that the spoken language cannot work or does not work. It's got to be a point in someone singing. And if you just put lines that could have been spoken into a lyric and make it some sort of feeble rhyming scheme, it doesn't work. The other one, the Taskmaster, is W.S. Gilbert. And I think you can only find two instances in the whole Gilbert and Sullivan canon where the rhymes are they're not being exact. Well, once or twice he does what they call a prose rhyme where you spell words. They look as if they should rhyme, but they don't really. And one, I think, where the scansion is not right, where the stress is on the wrong syllable. So Philip makes Drew and I, if we're ever writing lyrics for the review, and this last year we had to write it without him, and we always had this in our minds, you cannot vary the meter, you cannot vary the scansion, no half rhymes, and no codding. Because there is something in the human brain that even if you're not fully aware of these things, and you don't know, you wouldn't know what scansion was if you fell over it, if you hear it badly done, you register that it's not quite right. And there is something about the mathematics of good lyric writing, and you look at Sondheim, you look at any of those people. The guy who wrote Aladdin and... is it Menken?
Alan Menken.
Mm. Unbelievable lyric writing. Way better, than I think, than Tim Rice. Tim Rice had some good... You know, obviously had some great shows, but got a bit lazy later on. But those guys, it's extraordinary there. You listen to the great Disney musicals, Menken and whatever. They are beautifully written songs, and the lyric writing is fantastic. And they never fudge the meter, they never fudge the scansion, they never fudge the rhymes.
And look, and sometimes if you don't completely understand the joke, you'll still find it funny if it scans properly.
Yeah. There's something that tricks you. Mm. You think, well, that all those words fit in exactly the right place. That must be clever.
The Republic of Myopia. It's an original musical.
An original musical, yes. Talk about everything that could possibly go wrong in a show went wrong there.
Because you were opening the new Sydney Theatre, weren't you?
Yeah, we were commissioned to write it, and the idea was that we would have a play by Catherine Thompson, and the same company would do two shows, a play called Harbour by Catherine Thompson, The Republic of Myopia by us.
Yourself, Phil Scott, and Drew Forsyth.
And Drew was in the company, Philip was musical director, I was director, and not very good at that point. In terms of keeping an even keel in the room, because as Robin Nevin wisely told me, look, 95% of the job is just telling them how fantastic they are. Never a truer word spoken. Anyway... And we spoke to Catherine Thompson because we were both in the early stages of, you know, formulating these ideas. And we said, we want Peter Carroll. He's going to be these two roles. He's going to have a double as the head of the myopian and as an old ham actor. Huge role. Oh, yeah, no, that's fine. He's only going to be a ghost in mine. As it turned out, when the play came to fruition, I think Peter Carroll was in every page. He never left the stage in either show. So he was quite exhausted. We had this long sort of rehearsal period. Ross Coleman was choreographing. Unfortunately, his mother died during it and he had to leave. Then we went into a brand new theatre that there was a fire in the control room. The sprinkler system opened up one night and flooded the entire stage. The computerised flying system wasn't quite working. So the opening of this theatre, which is always fraught, became doubly fraught with two huge shows that were kind of under-resourced, really. Harbour played on the matinee of the opening day, and then this poor old cast had to come on exhausted and perform this new musical, which, shall we say, fell a little flat. No fault of their own. By the time the season went on and they found their feet, it fired. Needless to say, it's never been done since. But I think the time might be right to revisit it. Rewrite it a bit. And, I don't know, Whopper could put it on.
Absolutely.
We could do it at the Hayes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Why not? Yeah, we should think about that. Anyway, talk to the lads, see if they're interested.
And there's been quite a bit of debate about our Australia Day.
Oh,
and you were, I think you responded to that with a most magnificent comedy play. Or what were the origins of that?
Australia Day, the play.
Was that in response to all the argy-bargy?
No. That was in response to me being an Australia Day ambassador.
Right.
And going out to regional New South Wales and participating in the events. Look, it's become politically charged now, and obviously there are many people who don't think it's a good idea, but equally there are many people who do. And I think changing the date is kind of irrelevant, because no matter what day you choose, it will still be a black day in history, literally, for the Indigenous peoples of this country. And I don't think changing it from the 26th is going to alter one jot that fact. Yes, there are, you know, actions are significant, words are significant, but I still think that those who are rightly angry about it, that anger will not be assuaged, I don't think. So maybe there's another way of looking at it. But the play was written, I was quite taken aback by how much these communities invested in Australia Day and how much it actually meant to them and how seriously they took it. And they were, in fact, far more open to debate and discussion about the whole nature of the day and the notion of what it meant, particularly in the citizenship ceremonies, than people elsewhere. And then the Australia Day that is currently being debated by the inner-city elites, shall we say, for want of a better word. So I wrote this play. You've been in it. Marvellous production. Recently, because it was released for amateur rights and it's been doing, you know, really well.
Great.
People love it in the regions, but there have been two productions effectively cancelled.
Professional or...?
Amateur. One in Griffith, one in Albury, because local Indigenous activists objected to the play without having read it.
Merely because of its title, I guess.
Because of its title.
Yeah.
And I was sent a letter that had been sent to the guys at the company in Albury by this person who he had neither seen nor read the play. He had done extensive research on reviews. He misinterpreted the play entirely. The character of Chester, for example.
Right, the Vietnamese. The Vietnamese, school teacher.
The token, he called it, who was desperate to fit into the paradigm.
It's probably more Australian than...
Well, indeed. Yeah, and if you'd written the play, you would know that Chester is not desperate to fit into the paradigm. In fact, if anything, Chester is representative of the fact that all people from all corners of the world see the world differently and rub up against each other and bang up against each other. It's not always fatal consequences. There's a song on Avenue Q, which I directed years ago, called Everyone's a Little Bit Racist. Never a truer word was spoken in my mind.
Absolutely.
And I think everyone has to look deep into themselves and not maybe call it racism, call it prejudice, bigotry. You know, we are defined equally by what we're not than by what we are. We've always been in tribes, always will be. It's how you cooperate, get along, and don't ever assume that one tribe is better than another. But that tribal difference will still be there, regardless of how equal it is. The melting pot, we don't all turn into, you know, we move around the melting pot, but we're still moving in it. And that's, I think, a better way to move forward rather than, again, trying to ban things. I mean, to my mind, and the company freaked out. They had a meeting with an elder who wanted to change the title in the script, and they said, well, you can't do that. And then she rightly, you know, quite... says, well, can you change the date? Because they're doing it on Australia Day.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, well, yeah, that's fair enough. Move the thing. No, they refused. So, gone. And then it happened again in Griffith. And A, the shock is, you think, well, hang on, I'm being accused of being a racist, which I'm not. No. Read the play.
Yeah.
B, this automatic assumption, and this is what happens when you have identity politics, that everything has to be framed or about the particular identity that you are pursuing. Now, you can argue that there is a dominant paradigm of, you know, white, middle class, middle age, whatever. Okay, well, that may be true. That may reflect the dominant paradigm of the demographic. And yes, of course, it's great to have diverse voices and to have different cultures and different players and different all sorts of points of view. But not everything can be about your point of view. And when you start to say, well, if it's not about my point of view, it has to be banned, then I think you're reaching into very dangerous territory. And, you know, the words like decadent art start to spring to mind when, you know, there is what is deemed by the powers that be that this is acceptable art, that is unacceptable art. Where have we heard that before? I wonder.
Yeah.
And that's what goes back to that point I was saying about, you know, what we would consider traditionally the left, they're starting to do exactly the same things as we fought, well, not we, but our grandfathers and grandmothers fought to stop friggin' Hitler doing.
Yeah.
And you've got to, and people have got to start thinking about that a little bit more seriously, I reckon. And you do not solve these problems by banning plays. Or pressuring people to ban them. That's coercion and that's bullying. Particularly when you haven't read it.
Exactly.
That's what Fred Nile does.
Yeah.
Do you want to be Fred Nile? Okay, well, if you do, fine. But then don't expect me to agree with you.
Ignorance.
Hmm.
So, actor, playwright and director. What do you enjoy about that process?
Directing. You don't have to turn up 8 times a week and do it. That's the best bit.
You can leave once it starts.
You leave. It's great. I mean, there's absolutely... I mean, as a playwright, you surrender your play. I mean, I've seen some pretty dodgy productions. And you think, oh, God. But there's nothing you can do about it. That's the pact you make. Once you hand it over, you've just got to trust that they'll do a good job with it, which is not always the case. And as a director, there's only so much you can do too, and then eventually the actors have to do it. But at the same time, as a playwright, when you get actors, and you think, wow, I've never thought of that, or that didn't occur to me to say it that way, or it just brings a whole new life and a whole new world to it. I mean, you see different actors approach the same role, bring out different things. That's very exciting. But directing is fun because you don't have to turn up.
Do you think...
Even better is writing it because you don't have to turn up and you get royalties.
You just hand it over. Do you think the best directors... come from the stage, i.e. they have been actors?
No, not necessarily, because, I mean, most of the good directors have not been actors.
Right.
The best director is someone who can get an actor to think they came up with what the director wanted them to do.
So it's an intelligent psychologist.
Yes, and they are the ones who make the actor think, gosh, I thought of it all by myself, whereas the director had previously thought of that. And there are some people who are extremely skilled at that.
Is it difficult directing your own work?
It was interesting with Talk, which received scabrous reviews. I mean, boy, talk about a caning. But I think that was largely because it was a play about the demise of traditional media and the rise of social media. And it was a pretty, you know, nasty attack on the bloggers of this world and the people who are sort of starting to inhabit the public discourse. And they naturally hated it. And someone said, well, what do you expect? Of course they're going to turn around and hate it because you're having a go at them. They're going to have a go at you. The public liked it. And I think that's always a nice litmus test. I find, particularly with the modern critical voice, it's so feeble nowadays. And what's increasingly happening is that online critics particularly are motivated by a fairly narrow political ideology that they hold, and if they don't see it being reflected in the play, they don't like it. So they tend to review shows that they want to see rather than not that they've seen. And I don't think that's very helpful or very useful. And it's not traditionally what critics should do, but nothing you can do about it because anyone can ring up. So I've got a, no offence, a blog
or a podcast.
Can I have 2 free tickets? Indeed. Apart from this, this is great. Yeah, this is really good.
I'll pay for my tickets.
No, this is quality.
Good, mate. Yeah.
Well, you know, as an actor, you always rather play to an audience that is paid.
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, I would... They're the only ones you want to play to, really.
Mm.
Bunch of freebies, forget it.
Yeah. The Sydney Theatre Wolf Review is an eagerly anticipated event on the calendar of the year. Can we go right back to the very beginning? Am I right in assuming that all began with Three Men and a Baby Grand?
Well, it kind of did. Philip and Drew and I met on an ABC political series called The Dingo Principle in 1987 or something. And then we went off and did various things. Philip and a woman called Linda Nagel and I did a show at the Tilbury. Then I did Venetian Twins with Drew. And then there was a bit of gap and Drew said, why don't we, you know, Philip and I, you and I get together and we'll do a show at the Tilbury. So we did Three Men and a Baby Grand. That went very well. Three Men and a Baby Grand 2, went over to Edinburgh, toured around the country, blah, blah, blah. And then we were doing another show, I think, with Linda called Abroad with Two Men. Robin Nevin, who was then artistic director of the Queensland Theatre Company, saw it. She said, I've always wanted to do a review. She became director of the Sydney Theatre Company and she said, let's do a review. However, Wayne Harrison, who was the previous director, had already commissioned us to do a review for 2000, for the Millennium. So it kind of dovetailed quite nicely and those two will tell you that they were the ones who started it, but it was Robin, really. And then she pushed us into being more political. So when we started, there was hardly any politics in it. It was just sort of, you know, social, silly fun carrying on from the Three Men and a Baby Grand days. And then it became more and more political, and now it's just exclusively political. But that seems to be what people want. In fact, I'm amazed at the number of people who turn up, and it just keeps growing. And I mean, our audience is largely ready to knock on the door of God's waiting room, but we are getting younger people along too, which is quite extraordinary. And I think that's the phenomenon that's live performance everywhere is now attracting. It's the only interesting thing left, really, because there is just such a plethora. We've hit peak entertainment, peak content. There can be no, but it still keeps getting churned out. Whereas if you go and see something, it's a little more unusual.
Is it tough to come up with fresh, topical, engaging material every year? Or politicians are the gift that just keeps giving?
Look, everyone always says that there's so much material. Yes, there are a lot of things that happen that are, you know, the debacle in the Liberal leadership, although that happened 2 weeks into rehearsals.
So are you often difficult. Riding on the
spot? Oh, yes, often, yeah.
Yeah, putting in new stuff?
Yeah, as little as possible because we don't work too hard. but the issues largely remain the same. Tampa was 2001. We're still talking about Manus Island and Nauru. Climate change was first mentioned in the 1950s. So that's the problem. The hardest thing is finding new vehicles for it. You know, we've exhausted every genre. But, you know, they come up. And then you find sometimes, you know, just a straight monologue. It works the best if it's the right character.
Are you writing throughout the year or is there a time in the year, in October, where you begin the writing process? I suppose you're making notes through the year.
No, we start rehearsals in August, so...
Right, okay.
It goes forever.
Right.
We have a meeting next week.
Oh, okay.
To start basic, you know, basic concept, basic sort of theme for the show, design, that sort of stuff, casting, because I'm going to take a break from performing it this year.
Yep. But you'll direct it?
Well, co-direct. We co-direct. We create.
Okay, great.
Collaborate. Philip's actually coming back to write it.
Oh, lovely.
Well, yes, now we're annoyed because now Drew and I thought, hang on, we managed to do it and we only had to split the royalties two ways. Damn it. We've already asked him back. It's too late. So he'll come back and write. Andrew Warboys is going to musically direct again. Simon Burke's doing it, and I'm not sure. You know, maybe it's time for, depending on how many women are in cabinet, should Labor win, for two women.
Yeah.
I mean, we've always been accused of, you know, there's only one token female. Well, A, they're not token. Mm. None of them have ever been token.
Yeah.
And it'd be a brave person who said to Blasey Best or Amanda Bishop, you're token, or Genevieve Lemon. Think of all of them.
Valerie Bader.
Valerie Bader.
Linda.
Rebecca. Katrina, all of them, Helen Dallimore, they're not token.
No.
I hate that. But the truth of the matter is there just aren't enough female characters in the world of politics.
Mm.
It's changing slightly. And then you go and ruin it anyway by Drew being Pauline Hanson. So that's up.
Well, again, you know, the reviews are littered with those iconic impersonations from Drew and yourself, you know.
Mm.
I mean, you do a great Paul Keating, Tony Abbott, Bob Brown, Donald Trump. How do you find your way into those characterisations?
Donald Trump,
Well,
it was interesting because I was thinking, oh, gee, Donald Trump, this doesn't really sound like him. And then I watched a video of it and I thought, oh, it actually does. Shit. And it kind of looks like him too. Well, I'm a bit lazy in that regard. I'm not as thorough as the others. The others are much more, you know, you watch someone like Amanda, the way she approaches it, it's spot on. And she will work every syllable and everything, watch endless hours of video and listen to it endlessly. Drew is much more kind of particular as well. But Donald Trump, I just heard Jimmy Fallon go, Donald Trump. And that was that sounds like him.
Sometimes you're impersonating an impersonator.
Yeah.
Well,
impersonate, it's all tricks.
Yeah.
It's all an illusion. And someone suggested that, some awards ceremony, they said, you should come out as Paul Keating and then we'll get the real Paul Keating to come out too. I thought that would be disastrous because as soon as you're next to the real thing, people realise how little you actually do sound like him.
Yeah.
You don't sound like him. You have a couple of mannerisms, physicality that is the little key. You know, you do that sort of thing and you talk a little bit like that. And that does the job. But if you put it next to him, you go, oh, no. So knock that on the head.
Yeah. The audience does a lot of the work for you, I guess.
They do all the work for you. You just suggest and they go, oh, my God. The interesting thing about Keating this year was that they responded to the idea of him as much as, it wasn't me, they were wanting him. Because love him or hate him, and even in Glen Street, in the heart of Tony Abbott's electorate, they were desperate for someone like Keating to, or Howard, you know, from their camp, to come back and actually do what you said you were going to do.
Yes.
And
as effective leaders.
As effective leaders. Both those people ruled before social media.
Mm.
I say that.
Yeah, I think you've made your point. Yeah. which leads us into a lovely segue. You've got a Keating show coming up.
Yes, indeed.
This year, where we will see an hour and a half of Keating.
Yeah. Well, it's a biography.
Right.
I thought you don't really get theatrical biographies. I mean,
in the past we've had Tyler Coppen did the Robert Helpman.
He did Robert Helpman. That's true.
Yeah.
And that was great. Yeah. He was very, very good in that. In fact, that's true. But that's... can you think of any others?
No.
Well,
certainly not Australian.
I mean, Simon Callow did a Dickens. You know, people have done biographies of Dickens, played Dickens, but it's
and,
more to do with his
Truman
writings.
Capote, Robert Morse did that Broadway
yes.
play.
Will Ferrell did a one-man show about George W. Bush, but that was more just sort of comedy. But this is actually a biography, and it takes its... I've always been meaning to do it, and... after enough nagging from, you know, loved ones, I thought, right, okay, I'll shut you up, I'll sit down and do it. And I quite like the idea of a three-dimensional biography. And
so it's not
quite
just comic?
No, and it goes right back. And fortunately, it's now taken this... the raison d'etre for doing it is the paucity of leadership now and the fact that I will remind you of what political leadership is about. And he was always on about that. And when you look closely at, you know, you look at his prime ministership, the three signature policies of his prime ministership, there was not a vote in it. Native Title Act. the Republic, well, tried to get it going, APEC. I mean, really, who's going to vote for that? What was the other one? Compulsory superannuation. But, as you said, they were the right things to do. So he spent most of his prime ministership just trying to work out what the hell to do about Mabo. Nowadays, they can do that later. I mean, Howard, when it was challenged in the High Court, just squibbed it. And he has admittedly recently said he regrets what happened. But it was just put in the too hard basket. But Keating had the moral courage to do it. And he knew that they didn't have long... I mean, the reforms of the Keating-Hawke government are extraordinary. Now, some could say that, you know, it's not going so well now, but Keating never wanted to admit, you know, to any fault. And that's actually the difficult thing in this play, is trying to get an alternate voice that, you know, is not just his ego. He would argue that the legacy was squandered, that they put in place the reforms that were needed to get the economy into the world, but then subsequent governments have squandered, you know, the position that they set up. You could probably argue that, and he would certainly argue that, but, you know, other people might think otherwise. But it's about that, yeah, about what leadership is and what you have to do.
Have you met the man?
Indeed, I have.
Right. And does he know about this?
Well, he does. Well, I've met him before, and then I had heard that he was very antithetical, is that the right word, to this concept. Initially, I'd started it out, it was going to be a show of him planning his own state funeral.
Right.
And I met his sister Anne, and she said, oh, that's a terrible idea, that's really bad, because Paul will refuse a state funeral. He turned down his Order of Australia. He refuses to write an autobiography. He said, let my policies and my legislative record be my legacy, and he will refuse any state funeral. Oh, so I thought, okay, well, I'll change that. And I heard that he still wasn't too thrilled about it. But then a friend of his came and saw the review, and she said, he's got to see it. As much for the sense of love from the audience for the idea of him. So he came along, and he stuck around afterwards and had a chat, and he said, oh, go for it, you know, do what you like. I said, it's not about your personal life. He's a very, very private person.
Yes.
Nor should it be.
No.
I mean, politicians, and that's creeping in this country about, you know, their private life is their own affair, really. I think even people like Barnaby Joyce, you know, although he chose to do that and he exploited it, but there are other people you think, well, that's your private life, it's got nothing to do with us. And, you know, there are various politicians who we all know things about, but that's just accepted. So it's not going to be about Keating's private life, but it goes back to his early days.
When he was managing Dan's and
the Ramrods, yes. But, I mean, he's a political animal. He left school when he was 15, never went to university. He was the youngest member elected to the Parliament in 1969. He was briefly a minister in Whitlam Ministry for like 3 weeks before the dismissal. And then he sat through, you know, all the opposition. Then he had to, you know, see Bill Hayden get rolled by Hawke and then deal with Hawke and then eventually knife Hawke when he reneged on the Kirribilli Agreement. But like most biography, the more interesting stuff is the stuff you don't know much about, the early years.
Mm. So did he have any occupations other than the music industry before he went into politics?
He joined the Sydney City Council and worked in the electricity department.
Right.
When he was 15, and then he sort of managed the Ramrods part-time. But he got him a recording contract with Parlophone, and he met Robert Stigwood, and there was a genuine chance for them to go overseas. And he actually was prepared to abandon the politics, because I think he joined the Labor Party when he was 15, went to his first branch meeting, and he was in the New South Wales Labor Youth Council. But he was prepared to give all that up and go overseas. But the band didn't want to do it. They worked for Fairfax, and one of them was a public servant, and they thought, no, we can't do it. So that was that. And then when they decided not to, he thought, oh, what the hell, I'll try for pre-selection. And the rest is history.
What have you called the show?
The Gospel According to Paul.
Right.
That was a working title, but it stuck.
It stuck.
Couldn't think of a better one.
Perfect. And when can we see it in Sydney? It's happening throughout the
year. Well, it happens in Wollongong in late February. It's at the Opera House on the 13th of May. It's at Glen Street at some point, Parramatta, Penrith, regional Sydney, as we call it. And then hopefully it'll come back and do more. This is a sort of testing the waters tour. It's going to Canberra as well, which is nice.
Do you have much free time?
Well, there's a bit of downtime in this tour, unfortunately, right, because there's a few weeks where we couldn't find a venue.
Right.
So that will be free time. But, well, I've also got to write a cabaret show with Philip, I think. We're doing something. And then write this year's review, which is just the thought makes you, you know, the hairs on the back of your head go...
Oh, something will happen.
I know, but it's just does. Torture. Yeah. It's the most... Writing is a painful pastime.
Are there periods of great blankness? What's the
98% of it is blankness. And it's impossible working from home because there's always something far more important to be doing. Mm-hmm. In fact, I wrote a play for a little theatre company in Tasmania. I had to hire an office. I couldn't do it. I had to make myself go there for 9 o'clock and I was not allowed to leave until 4-ish. And that's the only way you can do it.
Now, will you listen to this podcast?
No.
No.
I don't know. How do you do podcasts? I don't know how to do it.
I'll show you later. I'll show you later.
Oh, no, I don't want to listen to myself banging on. I sound terrible on,
all right,
on the air.
Have you had a good time?
Yeah, no, it's always enjoyable. Nothing better than a soapbox. Oh, come on.
Thank you for giving up your morning this morning.
Well, that's all right. But, yeah, you know, people who have listened to me bang on about these subjects ad nauseum will just go, oh, not again.
They'll love it. Thanks, Jonathan.
Thank you.
Have you subscribed to Stages yet? Do so and keep up to date with every new guest episode as it is released. Subscribe in Apple Podcasts and through Wooshka and Spotify. And please take the time to rate and review the podcast in the iTunes directory. It helps to grow our audience and reach more Stages listening. I'm Peter Ryan.